listeners, and welcome to another episode of Compare and Campaign. I am your host, as always, Tom Lando, and with me, as always, is my co-host and co-DM and GM and HM, whatever, ST, bling, bling, blong. Who is it?
Miguel.
Yeah, we're GM, DMs, hosts, co-hosts, etc.
GM, and on this DM, not PhD.
And on this show, Compare and Campaign, if you're not familiar with it, this is the show where we talk about games that we have previously run, RPGs that we've run as GMs, DMs, STs, what have you. And we tell the tale of various sessions we've run of those games and how they went and what we had planned. And then based on those stories, we try to glean little insights on how we can run our games maybe a little better, or new games that we can run in the future. Does that cover it, McGill, do you think? I'm always trying to get down that.
Sums it up.
I'm always trying to get down that boilerplate, you know?
That covers our podcast mandate.
It is episode 102. Boy, we've been going at this for a long time now, eh? Episode 102, recorded on the 29th of March, 2022. We're right at the end of a month, so we better be ready with our recaps next month.
Yeah, I'm going to be talking all about the Mortal Kombat franchise.
Man, what if your channel does that Odd One Dies movie? Then maybe we could talk about that. That's a fun one. I like that.
Oh yeah, true enough.
McGill has a little online TV channel that he plays stuff on and he plays movies on. And I was watching one, and that was made me think of another one. I suggest it, and now I'm thinking, we'll put on that one. I'll watch it. I got another suggestion, but now I'm getting, like, this is just a whole other thing from the podcast. So the podcast, McGill, what do you got for this podcast tonight?
Continuing on a multi-session story arc in the verse, as the players have found themselves on a far-off planet, and they wanted to fence some ice that was mined from a comet, but their fence has come up dead, so they gotta find a new fence, and of course they're gonna get into all sorts of trouble as they attempt to complete this job.
It's maneuvering on wrong side of the law. Meanwhile, Haunch Darling's on the crew like, oh, I don't know a damn thing about this. I can't help in any way. Except to look innocent and maybe charm some people into taking, you know, giving them the benefit of the doubt or something. Meanwhile,
there will be lots of opportunities for Haunch to get involved.
I've got Operation Furnace Womb, the second part out of five in the final act of Al's Aces, in which our heroes, Al's Aces, have infiltrated the extraplanar hideout of their enemies, the Autumn Leaves, special sort of spy hunter agency that has been plaguing them this whole campaign. Now they've found their secret base, the Carven Spire, and they have infiltrated it and are preparing to sabotage it. They just got to hit every level and self-destruct this thing or something. But last episode, they got into the main lift access and headed down. And then this episode, they're going to be handling level two of the Carven Spire. And by the way, I wanted to shout out, actually, that these operations of this act are based on the final, maybe not the final, but the chapter of Princes of the Apocalypse with the sort of like end level dungeons in it, so the elemental nodes, basically. So I just wanted to give a shout out to the first dungeon is the Fane of the Elder Eye, which is what I used for level one of the Carven Spire. And then this episode I'm gonna be is based on the Howling Caves from the Princes of the Apocalypse adventure. So Carven Spire level one, the main entry access, that was Fane of the Elder Eye. And then this one is the Howling Caves, which which is I'm using for Carven Spire level 2. And I feel like it's my turn to jump on into it, eh? Or is it?
Yeah, I think you're up first. And I just want to say, Furnace Womb, huh? Add that to the fan art of the bizarre creature that your operations have been detailing.
That's going to be difficult because that thing was had pregnant insect in it. I feel like if you blur the lines between the two albums, then you're facing the listener with a terrible challenge. Like, you have to have some delineation or else everything's just gonna mash together. Although maybe you mash together and you make it into some sort of crazy surreal thing, you know?
It's a pregnant insect with a furnace womb.
It sounds like it's not gonna be pregnant for very long. You know what I'm saying?
Depends on the kind of bugs that it's pregnant with.
Unless it's the bug and it's pregnant with something else. If you're pregnant and your womb is a furnace, I mean, I don't know, maybe if there's a salamander in there?
Some kind of fire beetle?
Okay, so I was reading about this, and there's all this mythology about, like, salamanders and fire and stuff. Are salamanders actually immune to fire? IRL? Like, can you actually put a salamander in a fireplace? Like, it's like everybody was convinced.
No, they're like amphibians, right?
Yeah. So like, but then how was, like, every culture convinced that a salamander, like, liked to live in fire? Because that's where the mythology seems to come from.
I don't know for sure, but I can tell you that a lot of salamanders have, like, orange bellies. There's a specific kind called a fire belly salamander because they have these orange stomachs.
I mean,
so maybe that has something to do with it.
You just think that, like, Pliny the Elder, before he fucking wrote that salamanders live in a nest of a bonfire, he would have, like, taken one up with tweezers and put it in a candle or something. Been like, huh, that doesn't make any sense. Anyways.
Well, maybe we'll get some answers. I mean, a lot of them are able to regenerate parts of their body in the way that, you know, some of those lizard-like creatures do.
Maybe he burned off a salamander's tail and then it grew back and he was like, huh, there you go.
I mean, that doesn't sound all that unlikely.
The scientific method of Pliny the Elder. Pliny or Pliny? Do you go Pliny or Pliny?
I tend to say Pliny.
Yeah, I tend to say Pliny. It sounds funnier. He's like he's a Pliny the Ninny.
Oh, man, there's a gigantic kind of river salamander called a hellbender.
That sounds
cool. Why are these things so associated with being, like, monstrous? Salamanders are just... They're pretty chill, in my experience.
I mean, again, I don't know how an amphibian ends up associated with fire, but this is how we got started on this. So, players they descend. It's Alzaces, Chessie Dildira, Ara Stormblast Kendor, Nessalie Goodberry. They're top-level MPOC agents. They are descending down the Carven Spire in the, the main lift. And they head down to level 2 of the Carven Spire, but they find that in order to access the main sort of area of level 2, they're going to have to first make their way through what is effectively like a waste pit. Basically, if they were proper autumn leaves and whatnot, they wouldn't have anything to worry about making this journey. But the way into level 2 is otherwise quite hostile to anyone not belonging there that would happen to trespass. So they head out of the lift, and the first thing they come into is basically this pit where bodies and just, like, you know, it's like a disposal pit, where when the players get into it, there's this huge, it's one of those things where it's like there's a big industrial fan going, and that is providing disadvantage on their strength and dexterity checks, like they're having trouble moving against the air current. But then meanwhile, while they're trying to travel through this waste disposal, there are, of course, less corporeal monsters that have no trouble existing within the waste disposal and kind of, thrive in that environment. In the past, you know, the classic D&D is you've got a bunch of goblins and they've got, like, a pit with a bunch of garbage in it that's got an Odiag in it that eats it, or a black pudding or something. You know, now that I think of it, it's just garbage goober. That's a garbage goober right there. Usually,
I was thinking about what was it called? We've been over this. The trash monster from Star Wars.
Oh, the Dianoga or whatever.
Dianoga, that's it.
I think that's
Ona the Dianoga.
Yeah, something like that. So this is like more like a kind of. Now that we've brought the Dianoga into it, I was about to say more sci-fi, but then the Dianoga is sci-fi. But, you know, the Dianoga chamber, that's a vertical chamber, right? It's a vertical drop, and it's got a bunch of slime and garbage at the bottom. This is more like a horizontal chamber that at one end of it, there's one of those big industrial fans, you know? They have to... So that's giving them difficulty moving through the corridor. There's also, like, there's corpses everywhere. There's all this garbage I mentioned. But then in the corridor with them, there is a negative energy elemental. So basically, you know, they're in this base in the negative elemental the negative energy plane. And so there's just this entity that's just like a humanoid made of pure void energy is just like, you know, it doesn't have to breathe or anything like that. So it's just living in the waste disposal, sort of like, it's almost like antimatter, just like dematerializing garbage for the masters. But also, since there's a bunch of corpses in here, there's also four specters. So basically, the players have to go through this waste corridor where their movement is being hindered, and also they're fighting, like, incorporeal kind of mindless enemies that are almost more like kind of like the Dianoga, like just things living in the garbage. But they're things like, they're basically like ghosts and like void apparitions. But then the other critical thing is that as they pass through this corridor, if they do not get through in three rounds, then they are subjected to the purge sequence, which is on round three, there is suddenly a huge output of like fire damage, lightning damage, thunder damage that they have to save against. Basically, it's like there is a time sequence, like regular purge sequence, that clears everything in the chamber. And so basically they have three rounds to like get out, or they end up in the chamber during the purge sequence and end up taking just a ton of damage, potentially while they are in this combat with the specters and the negative energy elemental. It's funny because I've been playing Borderlands 3 recently, and there's a thing like this. There's a point where there's like a big thruster, and it's like periodically putting out like a huge gout of flame, and you gotta time it so that you run past so that the gout of flame doesn't hit you, because it almost definitely like insta kills you if you're in it. But if you're like running out of it and you like jump out just as the thruster goes off, it'll hit you for a little bit of damage, but you'll probably survive. And I feel like that's like really the sort of scene that you should be expecting from this purge sequence thing, is like the players, they take a lot of damage, but it's not like they get purged. It's just like, oh shit, and they like dive out of the backdraft sort of thing.
And then they're subjected to a whole series of horror movies where crime is legal for 24 hours.
Oh, yeah, that too. You know, that's Scott Aukerman on Comedy Bang Bang, he always likes, people talk about binge watching, and he says, I purge watch. That's why I watch The Purge. So
yeah, I'm going to binge The Purge. That's pretty good.
So then there's a bit of a funny thing is that the next area that they access, I mentioned those void curtains in the previous operation. They were basically sort of curtains or force fields that are protecting the Carven Spire from the sort of exposure to the void of the negative elemental, the negative energy plane. But once they get out of the waste chamber, they find themselves in an area where the curtain has just like broken down. They're in this area that is like a void breach, where they immediately have to be saving versus suffocation because they're basically suddenly like right out in just like the void. And what they find, like similar to the garbage disposal, there's like all these corpses around this area. But then one of the corpses, they find a fireball wand on them, suggesting that basically someone did manage to escape from the waste disposal and use their fireball wand to try and like blow their way free. And that is what has caused this void breach. You know, you could sort of, you know, Willem Dafoe reverse engineer the crime scene here is like, oh, I see. There was a curtain here, but then somebody was desperately trying to escape the waste pit. But then he didn't realize that he'd be breaking down the force field. And now we've just got sort of a, you know, a spot where the Carven Spire is open to the elements or lack thereof, you know?
I like that you went with the Willem Dafoe reference instead of like CSI, which is where my mind would have gone.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like because CSI, they don't literally, because they don't literally do the Willem Dafoe thing, do they? Like they see,
they never do the full walkthrough. Yeah,
that's what I'm saying. Is
or
like that.
Or you know, you could have also gone with Will Graham from Hannibal. He did the full reconstruction walkthrough.
I mean, I'm not gonna, between those two, even though I don't like Boondock Saints, I'm gonna go with the one that did it first with Willem Dafoe. like I'm gonna go with the one that put it in my head. And yeah, CSI like is more like, you know, flashes of viscera and whatnot, and it's like, whatever. That's not, it's not. Willem Dafoe in Boondock Saints seems to have a supernatural ability to recreate crime scenes in his mind. And that's what I really...
So true.
It's the kind of power you would have in like World of Darkness as like a high level vampire or something. It's like the spirits tell me what happened, what they've seen. Anyway. You know, and for those who don't know what we're talking about, just to summarize, in Boondock Saints, Willem Dafoe is a detective who can see a crime scene and then, like, get it to just sort of replay around him.
And actively takes part in it, too.
Yeah, you know, now that I think of it, this is also what they did with Sherlock, right? It's like Sherlock was always looking at things and then immediately, like, knowing what happened.
I feel like Sherlock is closer to CSI, though.
Yeah.
Like Willem Dafoe, he barely even investigates it. He sort of steps up. He's like, here's what happened. He came in through the ceiling. Like, he's just like, he instantly got it all entirely right.
Anyways, so I mentioned now that there's corpses in the waste disposal here, there's corpses in the void breach where someone managed to escape. So evidently, there's a lot of people coming to this place that, like, don't want to be here. And so this starts to make sense when the next area they get to is a jail. There's a Nykaloth, which is a type of Ugaloth, I believe. I've talked about these before, but it's effectively like a demon mercenary. It's like in Dungeons & Dragons, you've got devils and demons, and they don't like each other. But then Ugaloth are sort of this in-between faction that are they'll play whatever side, you know, appeals to them, basically. And so they act as sort of extra planar, not literally demonic, but, you know, demonic for our purposes, mercenaries who can work for any evil faction provided that the right price is provided. And so this Nykaloth is guarding the prisoners in this jail in the second level of the Carven Spire. So the players manage to defeat this Nykaloth and rescue some of these prisoners. And the prisoners... So I actually didn't really cover last episode is... In the first level of the Carven Spire, I did mention that there was a lot of, like, everywhere that they went, there was corpses, autumn leaves, gear, like armor racks, like racks of autumn leaf armor, things like that. But I also, like, it's funny because this takes me back to, like, the first session that I ran of MPOC's Finest, where I basically just had them go into this cult base, and then I had this long list of all the, like, mundane little items that were lying around in the basement and stuff, and then the players just sort of, like, took all the, you know, it's the Action Man thing of, like, they saw all those items and were like, how do I combine these to thwart the cultists? And so they ended up, like, making, like, a Molotov cocktail and then, like, making a smoke bomb or something. Anyway, all that to say, like, the first level of the Carven Spire, I had these very detailed lists of all the, like, little minutiae that was in every room. And so one of the things was actually in one of these rooms, I think it was in the storage room where the Chaos Minotaurs were, there was like a sack of nuts and there was some, like, jerky. And basically when the players found these prisoners, they were like, perfect, we found a use for the nuts and the jerky. Like, it's as if I had set it up for this, but not really. It's just like I had like little food items among the junk in the first level. And so then they happened to have nuts and jerky. And so when they found these prisoners, they were like, all right, you guys need to leave the Carven Spire with us. So go back to the... Like, I think they escorted them back to the transit lift to make sure that they were okay through all the, you know, void breach and everything. But then, and of course, they had rebreathers and whatnot, so they could get through this a little better. But...
Hey, before we go too much further, can I actually ask you a question about the Nykaloth?
Yes.
So, I just pulled up the sheet on the Nykaloth to refresh my memory on them, because I knew they were, like, fiends, right? They're sort of like demon guys with wings.
Yeah.
And I see here that they are telepathic, and they're, like, they have a decent intelligence score. When you have your players encounter creatures like that, do you roleplay those creatures as being, like, more sentient, or do you just say, like, he's here, he's attacking? Do they ever try to communicate?
It depends. I can think of a great example is when we were playing Ashes Against the Grain, I had you guys run into that Hetzru that was the big toad demon outside the Kuotoa demon's lair, and he was just kind of like, rah, master say no guard, then eat. But then you guys were like, no, but master, like, you know, you tricked him somehow. So I don't know, it's like, and the Hetzru obviously was of, like, low intelligence. With the Nykaloth,
yeah, because this Nykaloth, it says here, like, the sort of generic intelligence score that they give him is 12, which is pretty decent, and it can communicate telepathically. Like, I ran into a situation not that long ago with some of my players where they encountered a kraken that was in a lake, and they couldn't fight the kraken. It was just too powerful for them, so they tried to communicate with it, and it had a reasonably good intelligence and could communicate with them via telepathy. And so it went from being this monster to being like a monstrous type creature. Like, it was sort of animalistic in its desires, but it could still communicate with them. So, I don't know. I almost feel like it's a facet that can easily be overlooked by a DM, where you've got a monster that's going to fight these players, but if you look, it says like, oh, you know, they speak the same language, and the monster actually has an intelligence that's higher than some of the characters in the player's party. So, I don't know. I'm always sort of intrigued to hear if a DM leans into that.
I think it... So, like, let's compare these two situations of, like, the Hetzri that you found in Ashes Against the Grain. In that scene, I am kind of hinting, like, this animalistic demon, he's, like, he's just hungry, and, like, you can play on that, basically. Like I was kind of giving you an opportunity to play on his baser nature in that moment. Whereas with the Nykaloth, it's like the players come in. The Nykaloth, we should also like specify, he's guarding all these prisoners that they found in the Carven Spire. And so I think for the players, it was very much like, well, this is just a monstrous prison guard. Theoretically, they could have tried, like, as a Nykaloth, I think they could have tried to, like, you know, bribe him or pay him off. But given the situation, I think, like, between the three level 20 characters and the Nykaloth guarding the prisoners who are clearly in bad shape, they are not in any mood to negotiate or pay off this guy. They're just like, all right, let's take out this monster, basically. Like, because
yeah, that's fair. I mean, yeah. I guess a lot of it is just dictated by player attitudes,
and I think that, but I think the presence of the prisoners, like you know, it's very different if this Nykaloth is just guarding a door or something. Whereas, like, if this Nykaloth is, like, the tormentor of a group of prisoners that you're like, oh, shit, we want to rescue them, then immediately, like, you get a worse... The prisoners basically make the Nykaloth look worse, I think. Or
you know what? I've actually got a good comparison now that you're laying all this out and I see what you're saying. Like, we don't question it in Raiders of the Lost Ark when Indiana Jones just gets into a fight with that giant Nazi by the plane, right? Like, theoretically, they could communicate. This is a human being he's fighting. But we just accept it that, like, this is a boss battle. This guy's just out to get him. It doesn't matter what Indy says. This fight's happening.
Yeah, I mean... Yeah, I think similar to that. Well, I mean, with that big guy, it's also like, well, he's a Nazi. So there's only so much ideological negotiation you're going to be.
Well, same is true of this Nykaloth, though, right?
Exactly. That's what I was going to say, is like him. I think that the equivalent to he's a Nazi here is, well, he's guarding a bunch of like, clearly like bad like prisoners who are clearly in bad shape, like, you know, prisoners that have evidently been trying to escape or have even been killed and just put into waste pits, and then one of them tried to escape, and you know,
so in this situation, would you have allowed them to try and like dupe their way in, if they, instead of being like, there's the jailer, he's a demon, let's kill him, if they had come up with like, I wonder if we can fool this guy into letting us past, would you actually like role play that scenario?
Potentially. The angle I would have most readily accepted was if they came in and basically said, this job, it like this gig is basically over one way or another because we're going to destroy the Carven Spire, you could be destroyed with it, or we could pay you off and you could go, we could just go our separate ways. Like, I think that is the angle that would work with the Nykaloth based on its sort of like mercenary tendencies. It would be, well, except that also, like, they could have theoretically picked up Autumn Leaf's armor on the way in, because it was all over the place, and they could have come in and pretended to be the Autumn Leaves, maybe. So I don't know. It would depend on the tactic that was taken. But I definitely have an idea of like what, line of bargaining would work well right. with the Nykaloth based on its personality.
Cool. Yeah, don't forget, DMs, don't forget, some of those monsters are actually pretty smart.
An Odiug speak Odiug. So.
So if you speak Odiug, you're in luck.
So the players happily found some use for the nuts and jerky they had found by giving it to the prisoners to sustain themselves while they hung out on the lift and waited for them. And the idea was that when the players took their leave, they would take all the prisoners with them. But until then, the prisoners would just be hanging out in the lift where they had secured. And, you know, if they got hungry, they could eat jerky and nuts. They also found outside the jail, the Nykaloth had a number of magic items that had been confiscated. So here the players were able to acquire a +2 wand of wonder and a dragon slaying rapier. I also had a little note here, which at this point in the Carven Spire, since they're beyond the Waste Pit and the Void Breach, at this point in the complex, there is, like, they're starting to hear voices over intercoms and stuff to let them know that, like, the complex, like, the facilities are not just, like, active, but also they're sort of, like, waking up in response to, like, whatever's going on. Like, it's that sense of, like, you're hearing, like, the police chatter on the radio, you know? Then the players continue and they make their way to a lab that has poison mushrooms, a whole bunch of potions, and then it also has a dragon slaying short sword. So now the players have found two dragon slaying swords, like, pretty much right in a row. Who knows what that's about? Maybe the Autumn Leaves were collecting dragon slaying weapons for some reason. Maybe the rapier that they took from the prisoners in the jail, they're trying to reverse engineer, and that's how they created the short sword in the lab. Hard to say. The lab's, like, right adjacent to the jail, so, you know, maybe it was a science thing. Whatever the case, players continue, and now they're gonna come to a place, it's like a cliff, just sort of, like, overlooking the edge of the Carven Spire, that's just got, like, a big-ass void curtain. It's sort of like a big spot that would be open to the void, but instead it's basically like a cliff with a void curtain covering it. And the cliff is like a 100-foot drop. And then all around the cliff, sort of in like a ritual circle at the cliff, is these 9 cultists, and they got a black pudding. And this scene, I've been waiting for it for a long time. I've talked before about Destructive Wave. This extremely good ability. It really comes into its own most when you are a Storm Cleric, because Storm Clerics have these abilities that let you maximize thunder or lightning damage, and Destructive Wave, then you do this huge blast and you can maximize the damage, and you can hit as many people are within range with something that can, like, basically one hit kill, like, fairly, like these cultists, for example. He sees these 9 cultists in a sort of ritual circle around this black pudding, and so what Arakendor did, or rather what my brother did, he took his little Arakendor token. And he, you know, hops it along the grid over into the middle of the cultists. And he says, do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do, destructive wave. And puts down his token. And all the cultists died. And that is, like, the theme song for Destructive Wave now. I'm in a game now where I'm in a, there's a Storm Cleric in my party. And every time he does it, Spencer, the guy who plays Chessie, says, do 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 do, destructive wave. It's an iconic moment. Destructive Wave has its own theme song written by Arakendor in a moment when he waded into 9 cultists and trivially destroyed them on a cliff overlooking the void. So that's my story about the Destructive Wave song. I've been waiting a long time to tell that story.
And that persists to this day?
I mean, it's like, you know, it persists among those who remember it. It's like, you know, if someone
quick,
casts...
Tom, what are the magic words for Destructive Wave?
Well, I guess we'll find out if it has one. It depends what level it is.
Because if you don't have it already, clearly the magic words should be Destructive Wave.
I don't know. I should have it, but I don't. I have Destructive Smite, but not Destructive Wave.
Well, I think we know what the magic words are now.
What the heck? Yeah, I guess. Goddamn. Maybe it's that I wrote Destructive Smite and then I figured I just had it. You know? I don't know. That's weird. Because it does, it says component verbal. Like, the only thing is the verbal component. Man. Now I've got myself second-guessing myself, McGill. What have I done?
Do-do-do-do-do-do. I don't know.
Aw, man. That doesn't help me at all. Oh, you know what? I wrote Destructive Smite instead of Destructive Wave when I should have written Destructive Wave. So actually, Destructive Wave, not Smite, is Credenjo.
Oh, it doesn't start with a D. We can't do the do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. Credenjo.
Credenjo. Man, I gotta fix that. I wonder if that's errors in both of my notebooks that have the spell list. McGill, now I gotta do this.
What have I done?
What have I done? Volley. Destructive Smite. No, that's not right.
Smite's not right.
Yeah, and Destructive Smite isn't even a... It's a... Ha! Yeah, it was a dangus accident. It's a typo. It says... it's an errata. There's a post here. It says, in the list of spells in the player's handbook, one of the level 5 paladin spells is Destructive Smite. However, I can't find the spell description. Where can I find the description of Destructive Smite spell? It should be listed as Destructive Wave, as corrected in errata.
Oh, so it was a mistake in the printing.
And it must have been that I put the words there
before
the errata.
Or Dangus. Just based on the print.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Anyways. So... yeah, there was a bunch of cultists that were all having a little ritual circle around a black pudding, but then Arakendor just, like, basically waltzed right in among them and annihilated them with one huge shockwave. Beyond that, they discovered more cells containing more prisoners. These ones were guarded by a couple of invisible Barlgura, so these ones they probably couldn't have negotiated with. Unless, actually, Arakendor could have, because he could have used True Sight to see the Barlgura, and then he could have been like, hey, I see you. Do you want to talk instead of ambushing us? So, theoretically, that could have happened. But, as it actually happened, you know, it was more like they find the prisoners, and then these two, like, raging ape demons got the jump on them because you know, they had invisibility. Although Chessie, being a super high level rogue and stuff, I don't know, she probably had some level of blind sense is the point. Well, so like the Barlgura definitely were trying to ambush them once they tried to rescue these prisoners, but then it probably didn't work out too well for them. Whatever the case, these prisoners get added to the other prisoners that are waiting at the transit, the lift. Then the next area towards sort of the last area is there is a wind tunnel the players have to traverse through that has four Nightside Eclipse priests in it, and there's a effect in the wind tunnel where it's like it's difficult terrain, but even if you're flying it counts as difficult terrain because the wind is like buffeting against you as you try to proceed down the corridor and fight these Nightside Eclipse dudes. And then finally they get to the final area of level 2, which is the portal. And so each level of the Carven Spire after the first level is going to have a portal that connects the Carven Spire to some major Nightside Eclipse ally. And this first portal is the portal that connects to the Satan, or the Catan, which are the star-eating gods that originally joined the Nightside Eclipse as allies back in Empok's Finest, supplying them with the sort of insectoid infestation that the Empok's Finest dealt with in the last act of their campaign under Goblin Town. But the thing is that in all that time, the Satan have still been in contact with the Nightside Eclipse. Like, they still are in contact with that ally. The players back in Empok's Finest, they managed to, you know, purge the infestation under Goblin Town, but it's not like they defeated the Catan or the Satan or, you know, did anything to actually disrupt that alliance. So the Nightside Eclipse have always been in, ever since, been in contact with this extraplanar ally, and they have this direct link to them that allows them to bring through, you know, monsters, soldiers, weapons, whatever they need. I had also mentioned that, like, when they were briefed on heading to the Carven Spire, they were told that this is where the Autumn Leaves are from, this is where a lot of the demons are coming from, this is also where those reality bombs are coming from. And so when I talk about, like, not just bringing in, like, troops through these portals as allies, but bringing in weapons of mass destruction as provided by these allies, like, the Satan can easily make something as powerful as a reality bomb. And so the overall objective in trying to destroy the Carven Spire is to sabotage these portals so that the Nightside Eclipse no longer can draw on the benefits of these allies. And so this is the first one, is the players find the portal to the that connects the Nightside Eclipse to the Catan or Satan, and it's like, all right, we are gonna shut down this portal. And basically, like, I think it was actually something specific where they were able to, like, sabotage the portal so that they would basically self-destruct. And so they made it so that on every level of the Carven Spire, like the objective became each level, they find the portal, they defeat whatever ally is coming through that portal, and then they rig the portal to self-destruct so that when they leave the Carven Spire, at every level there's like this extra planar explosion that sort of takes out the enemy base. And that's the final objective. So this first one, they come to this portal. There are three extraplanar mercenaries that they have to fight, but the real enemy, the real boss monster, and I used for the basis for this was Yan Xi Bin, the elemental prince of the air, prince of elemental evil, prince of elemental evil air. That's it. But instead of Yan Xi Bin, of course, I was using a Satan figure from Warhammer 40,000 known as the Deceiver. This very, very powerful sort of, he's like a super tall floating guy, like lithe, skinny guy with like all these different horns curving out of his head. And he's very, very powerful. Or is he? Yeah, exactly. Point is, he's like a star-eating god monster, and so he's like a serious threat to the party. And he has all these crazy abilities. It's that Yan Xi Bin has these crazy boss monster abilities, but then the Deceiver, as an existing like Warhammer figure, has all these cool abilities like listed in its stat block. So I was basically able to rename Yancey Bin's crazy abilities with all these cool names. So for example, he could hit you with an antimatter meteor, which he did hit Ara Kendor with, and that was basically a save or not a save or die, but a save or drop. If the antimatter meteor hits you, you just immediately go down to zero HP. And luckily, Ara Kendor had a boon that let him, like, cancel out one attack. So that anti-matter meteor hit him, and then he used the boon to just, like, when the dust cleared, he was still standing, man. Epic boon. Other abilities it has, it can teleport around. It has a trans-dimensional thunderbolt. It has a lair action, which is a seismic assault. And then it has another blinding lair action, which is the Sky of Falling Stars. And so it's all these crazy, it's like, you know, one of these, you know what a boss fight is like in Borderlands and Dark Souls or what have you. It's like, he's this big monster boss, and he's got all these abilities that have like a huge area of effect and do all these super debilitating things. It was like a really hardcore battle between the Deceiver, literally a star-eating old one, and Al's aces. But in the end, they finally sabotaged the portal. And I think part of that was actually... I'm not sure now. I'm trying to think. I think there was a thing where they could have, if they had Skyfang, the cursed short sword that Chessie had gotten but not attuned to, that was another one of these weapons of the Allies of the Nightside Eclipse. And there was a thing where if Skyfang had been used as sort of the focus, then it could be used to sort of like overload the portal to the Satan. But I can't remember if Chessie actually had Skyfang on her at this point and used it, basically spent it to destroy the portal, or if they just used like a more typical Chessie kind of like arcane rogue kind of sabotage, like when she went into the workings of the big war machine that one time and sabotaged it from the inside. Either way, it's definitely within her abilities, but it's possible that there was also a thing where, like, she used the weapon to sort of override the portal. But all that to say, it was a really intense boss fight, and that was level 2 of the Carven Spire.
Hot damn.
Any thoughts or questions?
Well, we covered my thoughts and questions in particular about intelligent monsters as we went, but I have some news. I was doing some research on salamanders.
Oh yeah.
I have a hypothetical answer as to why they are associated with fire. And this is bonkers, man. I would never have predicted this. This is from the Wikipedia article on salamanders in folklore. So there are cited sources, and here we go. It says, of all the traits ascribed to salamanders, the ones relating to fire have stood out most prominently. This connection probably originates from a behavior common to many species of salamander, hibernating in and under rotting logs. When wood was brought indoors and put on the fire, the creatures mysteriously appeared from the flames. The 16th century Italian artist Benvenuto Cellini famously recalled witnessing just such an appearance as a child in his autobiography. According to some writers, the milky substance that a salamander exudes when frightened, which makes its skin moist, also gave rise to the idea that the salamander could withstand any heat and even put out fires by exuding that weird mucousy substance. It's not at all what I thought the answer was going to be. It's like, turns out so it's because they hibernated. Salamanders are like
androids and alien, and they make milk.
They exude, when they're scared, they like secrete a mucousy, milky substance onto their skin. I suspect that it's like a defense mechanism to make them harder to catch. Like, if they're all covered in slime, you can't really get a grip on them. But apparently, the origin of all of this was something that a lot of medieval Europeans witnessed, where they would put a log on the fire, and then, unbeknownst to them, the log was full of hibernating salamanders. The heat woke up the salamanders, and suddenly all these little lizards appeared in the fire. Heh. Weird. It's weird.
Yeah, I mean... Yeah.
I never would have guessed.
Just hibernating in firewood. Wrong place at the wrong time. That's what that is,
I guess. And this resulted in just like endless folklore about them being connected to fire when they are in fact amphibious and like to spend more time in water.
Yeah, it's bizarre.
Weird.
Any thoughts on the Catan Deceiver? Or the allies of the Nightside Eclipse, this final plot to take out these portals? Personally, I think it doesn't really measure up as like a final act. It works, but it doesn't measure up, you know?
I mean, they're going up against star-eating creatures. That's pretty big. This is, but as you said, you're like, I'm not sure this measures up as a final act. This is a problem I've run into in many of my campaigns as well, where it's, you want to have this escalation, right? You want, because the players are leveling up, each encounter has to be bigger and harder. And sometimes it can get to that point where it's almost like the point they're at with Marvel movies, where it's like, where do you go? They defeat, you know, in the MCU, they defeated Thanos, and his goal was like to take out half of the known universe. Where can you possibly go from there? So I feel like that's just one of those sort of story hitches.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just like, because I think the position that I was in Al's Aces was like, this is the second campaign in a series. The Nightside Eclipse are the main big antagonist. And I guess, like, in either act, you know, maybe the most obvious thing is to have the final boss be like, we're going to take out the Nightside Eclipse. But I, you know, it's one of these things where it's like, I don't want to toss that villain, you know? It's like, Or at least it as a super threatening, like massive universe full of undead faction, it shouldn't be something that they can just like wrap up in one or two campaigns, right? Like they shouldn't be able to just like beat a boss and then the Nightside Eclipse is over. It should be something that they have to take like multiple campaigns to resolve that issue. Which you sort of see that in the way that, you know, this campaign has the liberation of Catatonia, but then into the campaign that I'm running now, they are still liberating different areas of the Deathlands. So I don't know. It's also, there's that desire of like, you want to scale up, but at the same time, there's like a desire to maybe, you want, I keep thinking of like the term pull the punch here, but it's like you're pulling the punch from being the ultimate punch to end all punches. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, you're holding back because something big is coming down the road. Is that what you mean?
Well, except not in this campaign, right? It's like I just don't want to have I don't want to have the big bad just be resolved at the end of this campaign. But I didn't have, like, I think the ideal would have been to have some sort of, like, I don't know. The ideal, I guess, would have been to set up the Autumn Leaves more, because really this finale is like, you're going to take out the anti-Empok, which is the Autumn Leaves, And while the Autumn Leaves have been present throughout this campaign, they haven't been... There's not, like, a leader of the Autumn Leaves that's been built up as, like, a big villain or anything. And, like, yeah, I don't know, because, you know, it's like, you don't... If you are planning to do a series of campaigns and the bad guys are demons, then you don't want the end of the first campaign to be you kill the devil, right? Because then it's like, oh, whoops, we beat the final boss. Now we have to find a different enemy for the other campaigns. But, like, you need to find something beneath that, like, final tier that fits and satisfies. But I don't know. I feel like I tried to make the Autumn Leaves that, but didn't quite pan out. I don't know.
Well, from where I sit, it sounds like it panned out, but I didn't play in your campaign.
Well, that's interesting. I guess part of it is also the fact that, like, once they start going up against the bosses that are coming through these portals, they are just... The bosses that come through these portals are just representation, or, like, leaders of the ally that they are trying to cut off access to, right? So... They're fighting, like, a Satan Deceiver, but they don't really have a lot of frame of reference on who that is, or like, they don't have prior knowledge or interaction with them. They just find this powerful being that is supplying the Nightside Eclipse with allies, and then they defeat them. I don't know. There's a certain level of, like, villain recognition that's missing there.
Hmm.
Meanwhile...
Meanwhile, in the verse. So a quick recap on what happened last time. Because this is all part of a multi-session arc. So the players were hired by their ongoing employer, Grant Peterson, to pick up some comet ice from a comet, the last comet of the season, that Peterson has been mining for ice, because comet ice is really rich in methane, which makes it great for producing spaceship fuel. However, that also makes it really volatile. And because it's so volatile, like, if it's, you know, heats up beyond a certain point, it explodes. So they pick up the ice from the comet. They have a shootout with some claim jumpers who attempt to come and steal the ice. And then they make off for the nearest planet, to a settlement called Frisco, which is yet another sort of backwater mining town. It's a lot like Ezra. It's a lot like the place they hang out on Ezra. And they go there to meet with Alexandra, who is supposed to be their fence. And she's in a nearby smaller colony called Green Peak. But they quickly discover that the residents of Green Peak, including Alex, have all been wiped out by some mysterious disease. And so now they're sort of stuck in Frisco. The clock is ticking. They've got to offload this ice as soon as they can. And we sort of left off with them contacting Peterson, explaining the situation. And he says he knows a guy who works at a trading post in Frisco by the name of Wally Sackett, who might know of a way to fence the ice. And so that's sort of where they left off. And so right, what happens right away, next in the story, is they go to the trading post, they meet Wally Sackett, and he says, yeah, I got a guy who can take that off your hands, but he's not going to be in town until tonight. So they arrange a meeting time with some buyers in a shipyard later in the night. And then that leaves them with like 8 or 9 hours to kill before the drop off, before they fence those goods. And this is where the story for this part turned into a location-based adventure. One of these location-based adventures that I like to run, where I just I turn the players loose in a location that I have fully fleshed out. In this case, it's Frisco, this mining town that is straight out of the Firefly RPG. All of this stuff is already laid out. They've got a map of Frisco with all the different buildings and businesses. They have a little codex of all the NPCs that are in town. So I was just ready to turn the players loose and let them go where they will in killing time before their meeting with their new fence. And so I just first let them wander around, take in the sights, explore Frisco. They immediately gravitated to one of the saloons. It's called Lawrence's Saloon, and it is like the highest class saloon in town. There are gamblers playing cards. There's just like a whole sort of motley crew of NPCs that hang around the saloon. The way I always sort of picture one of these scenes in my head is like a point and click adventure where you've got like, you know, all the different characters just sort of sitting around and you can go and click on them and interact with them. The players could play cards. I believe Song played cards and I ran like a little card mini game. The main thing that attracted them to the saloon, though, is a poster outside saying that Madame Electra, Tamer of the Skies, is in town to put on a performance. And this is a performance. Actually, have you seen Guillermo del Toro's Nightmare Alley, the remake of Nightmare Alley that came out not that long ago?
I haven't.
So there's this part in it, part of it set at a circus, and Rooney Mara's character is basically a Madame Electra type, where they've got this big machine, and it's kind of like a Tesla coil Faraday cage kind of a thing. She wears like a chainmail outfit, and then like Tesla coils, you know, arc electricity across her body, and she's fine, but it's a very spectacular show with sparks and, you know, bolts of electricity shooting everywhere. And so Madame Electra does a very similar show. She's got like a big elaborate throne that she sits on, and then, you know, she gets zapped with electricity, and it's all very showy. And Minerva, having sort of a bardic streak in her, you know, she likes to play the violin and sing, and she's heard of Madame Electra, and so she's like, well, we have time to kill, let's go to the show, let's see Madame Electra perform. And all the rest of the crew are like, yeah, and let's also, you know, have a few drinks, you know, and play some cards.
Do you know the artist Rabbit in the Moon?
No, I don't.
They're like an electronic artist, and I find a lot of their music is like quite mellow and would not at all prepare you for what a Rabbit in the Moon show is like, because Rabbit in the Moon is known for doing things at their shows like the guy will put on a big metal mask, and then someone will come with a buzz saw and attack the metal mask with a buzz saw and shoot sparks everywhere.
Oh my god. Wow.
It's great.
That sounds like an amazing show.
It's funny, though, because I remember talking to somebody who knew the artist but had never heard their shows, and I talked about that show, and he's like, really? They do that during their shows? I'm like, yeah, it's really crazy. He's like, you would not expect that from the music that they play.
That's awesome. I'm all for that. That sounds great. Just like Madame Electra sounded great to Minerva, and drinks and cards and gambling all sounded great to just about everyone else on the crew. And so I turned them loose in the saloon, and a couple of things happen. So first off, you know, Song and I think Chow as well, they started playing cards, and I ran a little gambling mini game with them. And Minerva goes to seek out Madame Electra, but finds out that the show might be canceled for the day. And she's really disappointed, and so she charms her way into it, like a private audience with Madame Electra in her dressing room, and it turns out that Madame Electra had an accident in her previous performance. Something went wrong, and the electricity burned off a bunch of her hair. And so she's not going to perform because she doesn't look up to it. And so, oh man, you sent me a picture of Rabbit on there. That is insane. That is great. Minerva volunteers and goes like, I'll do your show for you. And so I did a little performance skill challenge where Minerva dresses up like Madame Electra and goes out and does the electricity show and like sings and performs on her behalf. And that was one of the, this whole session was like a lot of mini games because it's this location based thing. It's sort of like, you know, a gambling mini game. We're going to do a performance mini game. And then at this point, the saloon doors open and three people walk in. And this is where I introduced the antagonist for the next couple of sessions. I mentioned her last time. It is Saffron, who is going under the pseudonym Bridget in this. And I explained last time, you know, Saffron is straight from the TV series of Firefly, and the players all immediately knew who she was when I showed a picture of her, but part of the fun was role-playing it because the characters didn't know who she
was. This character was played by Christina Hendricks, right?
That's right. Very memorable, you know, indeed.
It's funny because, like, all I can really think about is how if I would have been Felicia Day, I would have been like, damn it, Christina Hendricks got that role. But I'm friends with Joss Whedon. I could have been that character.
You think that was the case?
I just think that if it hadn't gone to Christina Hendricks, it would have definitely gone to Felicia Day.
I do think that's probably likely. But yeah, this is the Christina Hendricks character from the Firefly TV series, notorious for being like a con artist, and you never know who she actually is. Her name might not even be Saffron. Nobody knows what her actual identity is. The kind of character that you get the impression that if Firefly had gotten multiple seasons, she'd pop up at least once a season as this like bad Penny type character, always turning up. And so in this case, she comes in with these two, like, you know, cowboys, these guys who are built like brick shit houses. And Gale recognizes one of the cowboys. It's this guy, Lou Blake, who he knew from back on Verbena. And in fact, used to work on his farm when he was a teenager. What the hell are you doing out here, Lou? And the two of them hit it off. And soon these two cowboys and Saffron are sitting at the same table with the characters who aren't, you know, performing or gambling. So it's like Caesar, Gale, and Danil are the ones left at the table. And this is where sort of this part of the plot starts getting set up. They talk to Lou, you know, Gale and him sort of catch up on old times, and the conversation leads to like, so what are you doing now? And the story that Bridget has told them is that she was going through her grandfather's old things. Her grandfather died and she inherited a few trunks of his old things. And in them, she found this old nav box. It's like a black box for a spaceship. And the spaceship used to belong to the Tongs. And it's another one of those cases where apparently there's like a big salvage still left on it. It's just floating out in space, waiting for someone to pick it up. But it's, you know, so far off in deep space, nobody really knows where it is. So there's no real danger that anybody else has pilfered it at this point. It's just on the edge of Reaver territory. But now they know how to get it. And she's convinced these two guys, like, let's fly out there and get the score. And this is happening over a bunch of drinks. And, you know, like the other cowboy keeps on elbowing Lou, like he's saying too much. But sure enough, the players are like, well, we got to get in on this scheme. You know, perfect. Another job. And we're right here. It's like kismet, man. We should do it. And so the seeds get planted there for this big scheme that they'll take part in, where they're going to fly out to a ship right on the edge of Reaver space and get inside and salvage what they can out of it. And I will say the stuff that they find on this one is pretty fun. But that'll probably end up coming up next session, because the last part of what they do, I will say, you know, the location-based adventures, in this case, I really did just cut them loose. I didn't try to steer them too much in any one direction. I just filled in any details that they asked for when they were exploring the town. You know, I'd give them a map unlabeled of the town and let them sort of dictate where they go. And they could ask, you know, what's this building? Okay, I want to go inside. What happens inside? And it's all pre-written for me.
Is this the one with the newspaper place that I went to?
That's right. It is. Same place.
Just going through the records.
Part of the write-up on Frisco in the Serenity role-playing game source book that I was drawing from is it provides all of these little, it calls them sideshows, but like they're sidetracks, they're D&D sidetracks, these little mini plots that people can get involved in. And so before getting to them fencing the goods, before getting into the whole plot about this spaceship that they're going to salvage, I just ran a couple of the pre-written side quests, sideshow, sidetracks, side whatever you want to call them. But there are way more of these. And this is another one of those cases I've talked about in the past where, like, there's a lot that the players could have done. And I just sort of went with whatever direction they wanted to head in. But, like, Green Peak was wiped out by a disease. They had the option of investigating Green Peak and finding out the cause of the disease. They opted instead to just never go there. They just stay away. And I will say that, you know, Haunch, it is a bit of a shame that they didn't investigate it further, because the cause of that disease was cursed treasure that they found.
Oh!
Cursed in that it just has a disease, like, stored in the box with it. So somebody opened the box full of treasure, the disease got out and wiped out the colony.
And our doctor could have kept me out of trouble.
Theoretically, anyway. So Minerva performs as Madame Electra. A bar fight breaks out, and the bar fight is another one of these sideshows. And this one is pretty fun because, like, a bar fight breaks out among the other patrons because people are getting drunk. Inevitably, some of the party get, you know, involved in it. Like, Chow tries to get in the middle and calm everything down, and then someone punches him and he punches back, and suddenly the whole bar just erupts in a fight, and I let the players decide sort of how involved they want to get. But unbeknownst to everybody, the sort of big hitch with the bar brawl was that this is one of those bars that has a gigantic mirror behind the bar, except this is a rarity in that it's an actual mirror. Most bars just have, like, a screen, you know, or something like that behind, or art behind the bar, but this is an actual mirror way out in, you know, the outer rim, and so it's of great value. And as I said, unbeknownst to the players, the thing you don't want to do is break the mirror. And so anytime any kind of projectile is used, someone throws a bottle or someone, you know, throws a glass or a chair, I rolled to see if it hits the mirror and breaks it. And inevitably, Gale smashed the mirror. He threw a bottle at someone, the mirror smashes, and suddenly, like, the crash is just followed by profound silence. Everyone in the bar, like, stops dead. The bartender is absolutely furious. And then the fight just explodes, and anybody who was trying to sit it out gets pulled into it. So it's just like a huge bar brawl, and I just ran it like some basic combat, and they get thrown out along with Bridget and the two other cowboys. And you remember last time, this is the other side plot that they took part
in.
They
meet up with Haunch afterwards, and he's like, oh, I solved the mystery.
I solved the mystery. I made it into the papers. you may recall last time that when they arrived in Frisco, they were mistaken for the mayor, and there was a brass band waiting to greet them. Well, the mayor has finally arrived, so they get thrown out into the street, and they can see the brass band is there, like, greeting him, and he comes up to the podium, and he's, you know, saying a few words, and Gale's friend Lou says, like, oh yeah, that's the mayor, JW, he's a good friend of mine, and let me tell you, he was just elected, like, about 4 or 5 months ago, and he cannot stand this job. Like, he's good at it. Everybody really likes him being the mayor, but just the bureaucracy and the stuffiness of it all, he can't stand it. And so Lou says something else, something that he's planning on doing this evening. And of course, the timing lines up perfectly that they can get to do this right before they have to go to their meeting with their fence. He's like, the JW has been invited to like this formal dinner at one of the local mining baron's estates. And he's going to go, of course, but he's been complaining to me like for the past week about having to go to yet another one of these banquets, dress up in a suit, and just, he doesn't find it any fun at all. So Lou's plan is he's going to basically hijack the stagecoach that's taking JW to the soiree and sneak him off. It's like almost like a bachelor party sort of fake kidnapping thing where they're going to intercept his ride and then drive him out to Frisco, take him to on a pub crawl, you know, have a meeting with some ladies of the night, and then deliver him to the soiree, albeit, you know, maybe an hour or two late. And so the players, who have already had a few drinks, and they're just like in high spirits, they're having a great time, they're like, yeah, let's get in on this as well. And so the last little bit of this session was them planning out this sort of stagecoach hijacking where they show up and they pretend that they're bandits, but really they're just taking the mayor off to have a good time, and they all have a great time. And then the last part of the adventure is them meeting with their fence and successfully fencing their comet ice before it explodes. And so the next session is going to be them following through on Saffron / Bridget's plan of going out to this this abandoned shipwreck out in space on the edge of Reaver territory to see what they can salvage, because it must be something good.
And nobody even knows that I solved the mystery.
Well, nobody in the party, but you're going to be in the newspaper.
That's how I figured it out, is one of the reporters had a scoop on the treasure that was coming to the planet, and he told me about it, and I figured out the mystery, because it the timelines made up that the treasure arrived, and then all the people died.
I like that, because we are inserting a character who was not in the original game. It's like there's this whole other sort of story going on in the background. He's largely ignored by the party because, of course, he wasn't involved in the actual events of the game. So we get these funny things where it's like, Hunch, where have you been? He's like, solved a whole mystery of a strange cursed treasure. Anyway.
It was all in the news. All the clues I needed.
Don't you read the newspaper.
Oh, boy. Local hero, Haunch Darling. So, I feel like this game, the verse, must be heading towards its conclusion.
Yeah, I want to say we are in, like, the final third of it.
Okay.
I ran 22 adventures, but some of those adventures were multiple sessions, and so they get sort of split up when I talk about them.
I guess the question is, like, at this point, I don't necessarily see an end point for the campaign coming together, which is fine, because, I mean, I just went on a whole thing about how I didn't really land the end point for my campaign I was talking about. But, I don't know. Is there something that's going to become a little more obvious as things go on, or?
Well, yes and no. It's more a case where, like, the things that are going to pay off are all things that are already in the background, right? We're going to have more with the Alliance. We're going to have more with the Tongs. There will probably be, I'm trying to remember exactly who, I'm going to have to go over my notes, but like NPCs from earlier on that come back later. But because I was treating this like a TV series, like if you watch You know, if you watch that one season of Firefly, I'd say only half of those episodes actually have any kind of through line. And then the other half are just these self-contained kind of things. Or, you know, first season of Mandalorian is another great example where, like, what's the overarching plot of the first season of The Mandalorian? It's really just, like, taking care of Baby Yoda. But all the adventures he goes on are just, like, he arrives in a place, he gets involved in a thing, and then he moves on to the next place.
Yeah, although there's the definite setup for the end where it's, like, at the end, he's planning to fight the Imperial hang-ons or whatever. I don't remember anymore. Oh yeah, he goes to meet Gus Fring. I don't remember. Or he wasn't supposed to, no. He goes to meet Werner Herzog, but then Gus Fring shoots them all. Oh yeah, because the idea is if he tricks Werner Herzog, then they won't be after the Baby Yoda anymore. But then that's all a trick.
Right.
I didn't have anything set up like that with my portals in the Carven Spire. That's my thing. Is like, I don't know. They just, I guess the ending as the players saw it in Al's Aces was more like, great job. You've liberated a huge chunk of the Deathlands. But if you want to make it stick, you're going to have to close some doors so that the Nightside Eclipse can't call in their backup. And they've just closed the first of those doors.
I guess to answer your question, though, yeah, it's sort of like, it's a mix of stuff. Semi-episodic, but, you know, some old friends will come back as well.
Tavern time! It's tavern time!
Sure is.
McGill, I know you got something for the tavern. I didn't really get anything for the tavern. I don't know.
All right, Tom, well, then you gotta get out your D6, because we're gonna be playing a game.
Oh, boy.
You ready? Got your D6 ready?
Yeah, I've even rolled it once.
So, for context, recently this guy, Oliver Dackshire, who runs a Twitter account for the London antiquarian bookseller Sotherins, he posted a humorous one-page role-playing game. It's a solo RPG, and, I mean, it's just a joke, really. Like, this is just for fun. It's not a for serious RPG. It's called Trapped in a Cabin with Lord Byron. And it's been going around a lot
online.
Do
you like English literature jokes?
Well, sure, but you know what? I don't think you even need to know that much about Lord Byron to make sense of this. Obviously, if you know who Lord Byron is, maybe it is a bit funnier. But I think this would work with no prior knowledge. And here's the setup. You are on vacation with Lord Byron in his holiday home, but the weather has trapped you and your friends inside the house. Only the strong will survive. So you have three scores, your three sort of score charts. They're not really stats. They're just like graphs that you fill in. There's scandal, masterpiece, and stress. And each of these has 10 boxes. So, you know, scandal goes from 1 to 10, masterpiece 1 to 10, stress 1 to 10. To start your holiday, first you roll on a Byronic event table to determine a Byronic event. And then you roll again on the subtable associated with that event to generate a score for scandal, masterpiece, or stress. And then you adjust your scores as directed by the event, and then roll a new event, and you keep rolling new events until your scandal, masterpiece, or stress score reaches 10. And so let's do this. It's very easy, and, you know, because it's a solo RPG, you're just sort of imagining these funny situations. You don't have to act any of them out if you don't feel like it. So, Tom, you roll a D6, let's generate a Byronic event.
I got a 5.
A 5. So there's a brief readout. That's doubt, but readout. Roll a D6.
A brief readout into what?
We'll find
out.
A 4. A 4. Turns out Lord Byron has an excellent supply of contraband substances. You get plus Ooh! One scandal and plus one masterpiece.
Get high, write my new book. Get high, write my manuscript.
So roll
get
again.
High, manuscript. Another event?
Yeah.
All right, so we got real high. Now what? One.
Byron's Recreations. Roll again.
Ooh, boy. So I hope he's recreating drug use. I got a three.
Can Byron borrow your husband? Of course he can. So that's a plus one to scandal and a minus one to stress. So you're at two scandal, minus one stress.
Sounds all right.
Rather than like do the full thing where we get to the full score of 10, because this will clearly take like a little while to run the full game. Why don't we just roll a couple of events on each of the three tables? Byron's Recreations, Byron's Drama, or A Brief Readout. So let's do a couple more of Byron's Recreations.
Okay. I got a two.
He's made a mess of your desk in the process. That's minus one to Masterpiece. You now have a Masterpiece score of zero.
You got too high. Spilled ink. God damn it.
Let's do one more. One more recreation.
I got a three again, so I got a one.
Is he aware that the walls are exceptionally thin? Plus one to stress. So now you have a stress of zero. Let's do a couple of Byron's Dramas.
Oh, man. He's talking shit about me with those thin walls. Or fucking my husband.
Yeah, it sounds like while high on drugs.
I got a five.
Oh no, Byron broke up with his latest...
He borrowed my husband while we were high. They made a mess of my desk.
Byron...
Fuck it.
He broke up with his latest girlfriend or boyfriend. That's plus two to scandal. So far you're on your way to a scandal score of 10. Because you have four in scandal right now and zero in masterpiece and stress.
Only because he goddamn messed it up.
Let's do one more.
Another drama?
Yeah.
Got a six.
This is the Tom answer from this table. He found a new skull to use as a goblet.
What does that do?
Plus three to scandal.
Oh no!
You're only three away from a scandal score of 10.
He murdered my husband.
Yeah, he did. He got high and murdered your husband. You could hear it through the wall, and now he's drinking from your husband's skull. Let's
it
was
do very sexual.
Let's do a couple of readouts.
Man, that was when he broke up with his boyfriend, was when my husband died.
Yeah.
I got another six.
Oh, he passes out in his study. That's a plus one to masterpiece.
Thank God.
And let's do one more.
I don't think I'm going to make it. I got a three.
Oh man, you walk around his house with underwear on your head. It's a plus one to scandal. So right now you have a scandal score of eight, a masterpiece score of one, and a stress score of zero. So we'll say, just so I can show off the end game, your scandal score reaches 10. You are no longer fit to enter society and must flee to nurse your reputation. You're exiled from polite society because of all of these scandals with Lord Byron.
I'm moving to Canada.
If your masterpiece reaches 10, you create a new genre of supernatural horror fiction based on your time with Byron. And if your stress reaches 10, you lose your patience with the man and either kill him in a fit of rage or otherwise descend into uncontrollable weeping from which you never emerge. And then the final note here is, as a special rule, if you roll three sixes in a row, Byron destroys your manuscript, either by accident or on purpose, during one of his episodes, and you reduce that score down to zero. So if you roll three sixes in a row... that score goes all the way down to zero.
feel like you could make a film version of this with like Jodorowsky or something.
Oh yeah, that'd be great. Trapped in a cabin with Alejandro Jodorowsky.
Jodorowsky is convinced that a pop rock band would be perfect for the soundtrack. Add three stress.
I love it. I might have to do a rebrand of this with Jodorowsky or even Werner Herzog. That would be great.
Man, well, I was going to say, if you do Jodorowsky, chances are you can get him to respond to it because he's a pretty open guy.
It's true. He'd probably love it. He'd probably say something.
He'd probably retweet it.
He probably would. Anyway, so that's Trapped in a Cabin with Lord Byron, one-page RPG by Oliver Darkshire. You can find it on Twitter. I will link to it, of course, on our Compare and Campaign WordPress. But I thought that this was just a real amusing little game, extremely entertaining, one-page solo RPG. You know how I like those like bite-sized games like that.
Yeah, I don't know. I like to use the whole meat. You know me.
Not me.
I'm doing Prince of the Apocalypse, trying to use the whole meat. Use all the rooms and everything. All that. You use the whole meat around here. Anything else, McGill?
That cabin that Byron's in? It's haunted!
Okay. So, this has been episode 102, recorded on the 29th of March, 2022. If you want to get in touch with us, see when we post new episodes, or just follow us on Facebook, check us out on Compare and Campaign on Facebook. And if you want to see our show notes, supplemental materials, things we talked about, little videos, see a picture of Rabbit in the Moon doing their nonsense, check us out on comparingcampaign.wordpress.com. Yeah, watch out, you know, don't steal because it's haunted. Not me.
Level up.
Yeah.
Get your ding.
Or however many epic boons you need to survive that antimatter meteor. Take care, everybody.